Aloha and mahalo to our Hawaiian brothers and sisters, yo dudes and dudettes on the West Coast, hey yous guys on the East Coast, a nostalgic hi y'all to my kin and friends in Dixie, as well as a hearty boy howdy to the lonesome cowboys and cowgirls of the Southwest, and from there all the way up to America's North Coast, every place in between. Hi, guys. It's another Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett. And thank you to everybody, too, in Canada who listens and writes and lots of email from people who were in Canada who were concerned about this 35W bridge collapse, which happened here, as you know, last Wednesday evening. Many of the people that wrote this week wrote kind words after seeing me, or rather, I guess, more accurately, just hearing me on with Anderson Cooper on CNN for about 2.5 hours. And it was quite a day, actually. It was a kind of a fluky thing that I should end up having to sort of dust off my reporting skills and going back to some kind of regular stand-up kind of ask the police officers, get the latest kind of details sort of reporting, which I don't do very often anymore. But still, it was nice just to be able to help out CNN. And it was a pleasure even greater, though, to step aside the next day when the A-team arrived into town. And they brought in the real reporters and they brought in the real journalists who have been working the story ever since. It is a tragic story. And although I was happy to be on the special teams, it's a story that deserves everybody's best attention. The good news, again, from the Twin Cities today is that there are many, many fewer people presumed killed, only 8 now on the missing list. This is a fairly tight list of people who were sort of almost known for sure to be on that bridge or whose cars have been found in the water. And then, of course, the list of 5 that we already have confirmed dead from last late Thursday and Friday. Now, what still remains a wild card are the number of people who just haven't come home yet, who may or may not have been traveling through the area, people who don't have close friends or family that are keeping track of them. There is a strong current in that river, and while some cars went upstream and some went down, not everything is known yet about what is waiting for us and I mean this quite literally, murky depths of the Mississippi, the silt being so high, the sonar being so necessary, and there being more than 1 or 2 old cars or metal vehicles down there that are kind of distracting investigators as they go. So the outlook is optimistic that it will only be, say, 15 or so dead. And whereas you hate to have even that number that high, you wish you never have 0, considering what the potential was, had there been all lanes open, all 8 lanes open, had it been a half hour, 45 minutes earlier, had the bridge gone in a different one direction or another, or the collapse happened in a slightly different way, and more cars have been dumped in the Mississippi as opposed to the cars that they found that were still on the actual bridge itself, the death toll could have been considerably higher, 10 times higher. And so we're just all just so grateful here, even while we hold the people that are missing in our hearts. And we hope that you do, too. Thank you for all the kind email, too, just for people who wrote to say glad it wasn't you or yours on that bridge. That all having been said, we've got a big show ahead this evening on Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to try to squeeze in Mary Capps between now at the top of the hour, but I guess I'm putting William Henry on notice that we might be a minute or two late for class coming up next hour. William Henry's a very interesting guy. You may have heard George giving me the heads up on him last night. I had been looking at his DVDs. I hadn't had a chance yet to sit down with this book, which I did earlier this evening. But we'll be talking about some pretty heady material that is very interesting, yet I think you'll find grounded in some pretty good research. And here's a guy who's spent a lot of time really trying to break some new ground. And that includes traveling to these sites that he often writes about and speaks about. William Henry just got back from Rennes-le-Château, and we'll talk more about that coming up next hour with him as well. But Mary Capps, this this hour. She'll be our guest. Her book is My Boss Was the BTK Killer. And she has a lot to say about the BTK dog catcher and her work with him in Park City, Kansas. More on that after a little crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Mary Capps then coming up in just a few minutes, and we'll start exploring what it was like to work for the BTK killer. Anybody who listens to this show or to the old Coast to Coast Live knows I have kind of a fascination with the mind of pure evil. What with the shows we've done with Catherine Ramsland or the shows we did on the Iceman or Dean Koontz, whom I'm looking forward to having back on again sometime. It seems a never endless pursuit of what is it about the evil that makes them both so difficult to track and to find. I mean, how can they operate like this wide open? Mary Capps says she had her suspicions, and we'll talk more about that coming up in just a minute. There's a story that you might hear more on next week on Coast to Coast AM with George Noory, as details are still developing. But Britain has banned all exports of meat. There is a contained but potentially cataclysmic outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the English countryside, and the government may have started it somehow. That leads off crypto news for tonight. From Sky News in England, the foot and mouth outbreak at a farm in Surrey may have been caused by a leak from a nearby animal research laboratory. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs said the virus is the same as one being used at the Purbright Laboratory just a few miles from the farm. Experts said the strain was not one recently found in animals, but was similar to ones used in diagnostic laboratories and vaccine production. In fact, I think this particular strain had been isolated to one found in 1967. That strain is present at Purbright's site's Institute of Animal Health and was used in vaccine batches made last month. What might be the easiest way to fix that? Well, perhaps time travel is the answer of the future. I know it's my personal hope for salvation for the time being. Jerusalem Post story, could all our blunders be reversed, our failings eliminated? Perhaps so, if an Israeli scientist's research is to be believed. With the help of Professor Amos Ori, we may be just able to go back in time and stop the screw-ups from happening in the first place. That's great news for me. There's a certain lemon-yellow tuxedo that I wore to my junior prom I'd like to take back. But where were we? In a paper published in the latest issue of the Physical Review Journal, the scientist offers a theoretical model based on mathematical equations describing conditions that, if established, could help lead to the development of a time machine of sorts. But rather than building an actual device, the professor explains, the machine is space-time itself. The details of Dr. Ori's research are so complicated as to be baffling, writes the Jerusalem Post. In a 2004 paper, Ori outlined a set of conditions that would allow for the creation of a time loop without the need for so-called exotic matter. According to that theory, the time loop would form as a donut-shaped vacuum inside which time would curve back on itself so that a person traveling around the loop might be able to go further back in time with each lap. Now, I know that this story lost me and went over my head when, after reading it, my mind suddenly slipped into donut-shaped time loops. And if you haven't seen it yet, the new Simpsons movie is great. Speaking of which, under pressure from President Bush, House Democrats on Saturday grudgingly prepared to move ahead with approving changes in a terrorist surveillance program, despite serious reservations about the scope of the measure. The story says, with time running out before a scheduled month-long break and the Senate already in recess, House Democrats confronted the choice of accepting the administration's bill or letting it die. If it died, that would leave Democratic lawmakers, who have long been anxious about appearing weak on national security affairs, facing an August fending off of charges from Mr. Bush and Republicans that they left Americans exposed to terror threats. Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell said, I can't imagine why they, the Democrats, would take a month-long vacation without fulfilling their obligation to keep America safe. Meanwhile, Representative Louise Slaughter, Democrat of New York, said they have got us in a vice. Ah, where is that good old-fashioned donut-shaped time loop when you need one? Donut-shaped time loops. Meanwhile, Newt Gingrich says the war on terror is phony. The former speaker says that energy independence is the key. This is a story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm quoting here. He says, none of you should believe we are winning this war. There is no evidence that we are winning this war. The ex-Georgia congressman told a group of about 300 students attending a conference for collegiate conservatives. He was unstinting in his criticism of his fellow Republicans in the White House and on Capitol Hill. We were in charge for 6 years, Newt said, referring to the period between 2001 and early 2007, when the GOP controlled the White House and both houses of Congress. I don't think you can look and say that was a great success. By the way, there's an element of that whole national security issue in this weekend's big movie, The Bourne Ultimatum, which has many references to the expansion of unchecked CIA powers that were pushed through under the claim of national security when it was really all about a power grab. That's in the movie. It's a great movie. If this is how the series ends, the Bourne series, I couldn't be happier with the ending, but it would sure be nice to see this character in just one more installment. Perhaps like finally settling down and happy, but suddenly faced with circumstances that would require him to be the super spy that we know he is just one more time. That would be really cool. The London Times reporting, women who stay out of the sun are increasing their risk of developing breast cancer. That according to a new study. The safe tanning messages that are drummed into women each year may help to reduce their risk of skin cancer, but at the cost of increasing their risk of breast cancer. The majority of vitamin D comes from exposure of the skin to sunlight, but many women exposed less in winter and reluctant to bare themselves in summer because of the dangers are deficient in vitamin D. There has been anecdotal evidence to suggest that breast cancer is less common among women who live closer to the equator, where the sunshine is stronger. And doesn't that go back to a previous radio guest? The radio guest I had, I think, on Coast to Coast Live still, right? We hadn't switched back to Coast AM, that established who was proving that women who go braless have a greatly reduced rate of breast cancer. And he likened that to women who live closer to the equator. Said in island nations and, you know, warm weather nations where women are more inclined to go braless or to be topless. Now, not just braless, but perhaps topless if it means getting more sunshine. The risk of cancer is reduced in women who are braless and tan more. Some enterprising young medical researcher should be headed for the Sturgis. Starts on Monday. Look for me at the Sturgis. I'll be on my Vespa. Holding my wife's shirt down. Speaking of girls gone wild, Reuters reports in Tehran, Iranian police detained more than 200 people and seized alcohol and drugs in a raid on a satanic underground rock concert, Iranian media reported on Saturday. Iran, which has launched an annual summer crackdown on, quote, immoral behavior, bans alcohol, narcotics, and parties with unrelated men and women dancing, drinking, and mixing. If they're unrelated, they can't dance or mix. Western popular music is frowned upon. 150 bottles of alcoholic drinks, 800 obscene CDs, and different kinds of drugs have been confiscated by police, as well as, quote, inappropriate dresses. Police detained but did not arrest the headline performers for this satanic underground rock concert. Air Supply, the Little River Band, and John Davidson. Okay, not really. Okay, not really, but isn't that a great internet rumor we could start? Again, I want to thank everybody who emailed in this week and lots of interesting comments. We'll just have to save them for another show because I want to get to Mary Capps here in just a moment. But I do have one or two follow-up thoughts, one of which is if you want to read crypto news, you can find it at my blog. It's on there. It's on our website right now. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, The link for my blog is in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. And I try to post things up there all the time. It's been kind of a sparse week, I think, though, for postings in light of the collapse of the 35W bridge. Some people had emailed in and said, hey, does this have anything to do with the Kanamex Highway? President Bush's interest in rebuilding this, and could this be a significant part of the Kanamex Highway from Mexico to Canada? Yeah, I don't think so. Because the 35W bridge isn't even a significant part of 35W. But other people writing still wondering whether or not terrorism could be involved as of last report. No. Still back to last week's show, though, I got this message from Allison. She thought we'd be interested in hearing some 19th century articles with accounts that are similar to the Steelville Railroad ghost story. These reports appeared in Milwaukee, in the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Daily Sentinel, about incidents that occurred on railway lines that go through Illinois, although I'm not sure if they passed near Steelville. And this is from Allison. One article is quite old. It said here, it is said that specters, vampires, and goblins are seen at night by the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad. The Burlington Hawkeye is responsible for the following story. The queer sights at night on the Chicago and Burlington Railroad continue. An engineer on the railroad says that he was approaching Galesburg, Illinois, a few nights since. He suddenly saw a woman standing upon the track about 10 feet ahead of the engine. The train was at full speed and, of course, could not be stopped. The engineer remarked to the person on the engine that that was the first person he had ever killed during his railroad experience. Arriving at the depot, he sent men and lights back to the spot where he saw the woman, but no sign or trace of anything was there. There was no body, no blood, no marks upon the track. Next morning, the search was renewed with no better success. It is said that the lights have been lighting several acres of land with the brilliance of noonday, trying to find something. This speaks directly to the story of the Steelville, Illinois ghost that we talked about last week with the editor of the Steelville paper. And I think we'll need to revisit that coming up, especially in light of this story. It's small print. And I'm not sure how old this is, but it looks at least 60 or 70 years old. And there's the story. The Racine Journal publishes this ghost story. During the past 3 or 4 years, several men have been killed by passenger trains on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad in the town of Caledonia. Usually the railroad people were not in the least to blame. All the four-mile road there have met death. Not long ago, a passenger train was coming through at a rate of about 30 miles an hour. Suddenly, the engineer peered out of the cab window and was dead sure he saw a man on the track, and then the engine struck him and threw him and then over a fence into a field. The train was stopped, and the crew went back and searched for 20 minutes but failed to find anything. It was reported at the depot here, and next morning another search was made and proved to be fruitless. The affair was the talk of the railroad men for weeks. Less than 6 weeks ago, the engineer of a freight train thought he saw a man on the track at the same point and was sure he struck and killed someone, but a search failed to reveal a dead body then either. Another man was fooled the same way a day or two ago. Railroad men say that this is the ghost of some men who have been killed at that place. So it's creepy and it's spooky, and it's something which we'll continue to track on coast to coast with the help of anybody down around Steelville. It's not nearly as spooky, though, perhaps, or creepy as what it would have been like to be Mary Capps. She's the author of my book, My Boss Was the BTK Killer. And good evening, Mary.
Good evening. Well, good morning on my part.
On yours. In Park City, Kansas, you worked with Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, when he was a dog catcher?
Well, code enforcement, animal control was part of our job duties. We handled all the city codes and enforced them in the court of law that were not criminal.
And so you first began to work with Dennis Rader in what year?
1998.
Okay. And did you get a good vibe from him the day you met him, your new boss?
No, no, I didn't. I mean, there was nothing unusual about him, but, you know, just, he put off the air of being a loner right off from the very beginning. He didn't make small talk, made it very clear that he didn't want to talk about personal issues at work, and pretty much stayed to himself.
Well, that's where it starts, but that's not where it ends, obviously. We'll talk more with Mary Capps, who worked as that compliance officer for the for Park City, Kansas, under the direct supervision of Dennis Rader. What more did she start to learn or suspect about her boss, whom we now know as the BTK killer? You'll hear about it, this new book, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll get to William Henry coming up next hour, investigative mythologist and on a mission to reveal the lost codes of myth and symbols. So much so he just got back from Rennes Le Chateau. We'll ask him about that, but also some of his other work is as somebody investigating Starwalkers and the dimensions of the blessed. More on that coming up next hour with William Henry. First, the very cursed mind of the BTK killer. Mary Capps knew it all too well. She'll tell us about what it was like to work for Dennis Rader next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Mary Capps, I guess we should probably start with a quick recap of the number of victims of Dennis Rader, your former boss, the BTK killer, so-called, for bound, torture, and kill his victims. Did you know any of his victims, Mary?
Not personally. Maureen Hedge, his victim in 1985, she lived about four doors behind my grandma and my grandpa and my aunt and uncle, and they knew her real well. I knew her from the neighborhood. That would be it.
Do we know for sure what year Dennis Rader started binding and torturing and killing victims?
The only thing that they know for sure is what he has claimed and admitted to, and that would have started in 1974.
Wow.
Going through to 1991.
Let's talk about your life with him as he became your boss, because you had some distinct, just kind of, you know, creepy vibes, you said, from the beginning on this, and yet you didn't. Would you have had any suspicion at all that he could have been capable of something as heinous as being a serial killer from starting in 1974?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I didn't think he was smart enough. It never crossed my mind that he could have possibly have been, you know, the BTK killer when he started re-communicating in 2004. It just never crossed my mind. I mean, just dealing with him over 40 hours a week on a day-to-day basis, knowing his, you know, how he thought and how he worked, I couldn't wrap my mind around the fact that he could have been smart enough just based off what the profilers gave. And then, of course, you know, after they did capture him, it was known that he wasn't that smart, and he was just lucky.
Yeah, that he was very lucky. Was he cunning?
Mm-hmm.
Would you have used that word cunning with him?
Yes, I would. I would say that he was cunning, deceitful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good at that. So, and yet, in your experience with him, you did get certain kinds of feelings from him because he had what? His other ways in which his so-called BTK code was being lived out at the office?
Oh, absolutely. Right from the very beginning, Dennis, when we entered things into the computer or if it was on paper, he always used codes, including in memos that he would give to me or give to the police department, which was a whole other department, or to the water department. And then he would give a little a synopsis that went with it, so the person who was reading his notes would know what those codes stood for.
Now, explain what this means.
A lot
because
of time doing this.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, I guess maybe we should explain a little bit about what the BTK codes were. Can you go over that with a brief synopsis?
Yeah, what I worked with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I call him BTK codes now, since he's been arrested, and that was, I have a lot of anger about that because I used to complain about that all the time. Dennis had thousands and thousands of codes for everything. Let's say, for instance, the violation log. He would use VL for violation log and then the last two digits of the year, you know, for that violation.
Right.
You know, it was so bad. He had so many of these, and I mean thousands of them, that when he would give me a note, you know, I'd have to go to a book and go through it and spend, you know, hours trying to figure out his note. You know, it was always a puzzle for him.
And that seems like the way that the letters were being written to taunt the police?
Yes, yes. He right. used codes with him. However, those were never made public to the public. You know, they never released those codes. You know, it's amazing to me, had they released them, how many people besides myself would have experienced this, you know, prior to his capture, would have stepped forward and said, hey, it's him.
Yeah, that's pretty unique. That's sort of a thumbprint. I think you're right. I mean, I think there's something about that. I worked with a guy who, and he was otherwise normally sane, at least we mm-hmm. were led to believe, but he would write, he would draw in all day long when, as part of his doodling, a series of triangles and squares. And he would just put them all in. It was almost like his own little binary code. And he will fill up whole pages mm-hmm. of triangles and squares. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, if I ever saw that on a serial killer's letter to a police department, I would be raising my hand going, okay, I know who that is. I mean,
it's
pretty unique.
But there was so much stuff that was not released to the public till after his arrest. And, you know, and the reason why they gave was they didn't want copycats. And,
right.
You know, that makes sense. But, you know, the thing is he was right under their nose for 30 years.
Well, there's another way, though, that they might have, that fate might have ended the life of the BTK killer, and that was thwarted by your aunt. Is that right? Is that the story?
Pardon me?
The story about how your aunt saved the life of the BTK killer?
Oh, my aunt? Yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, they were adding on to the back of the building. Actually, it was mine and Dennis's office that they were adding on to enlarge it, because at the time that I was hired and for the first 2 years, Dennis and I used an office that was only large enough for one person. If we stood up, we would have bumped into each other. So they built this larger office at the back of the building, and they had taped and metted over the weekend, and it was going into the first part of the week, and they left a propane heater on through the night. And Dennis got into work a half hour early and was slumped over his desk from carbon monoxide, you know, being overtaken by it. And my aunt and another co-employee went in and found him and picked him up, you know, put an arm over each shoulder and took him out of the building.
What year was that?
I believe that was in 2000.
And where is that in the timeline of the BTK killer death march? I mean, I'm trying to remember it. Was he only sending notes to the police by that point, or was he still committing crimes?
Communicating. He murdered in 1985, 1986, and 1991. Those three murders went unsolved and unclaimed. Dennis didn't, BTK, Dennis Rader, did not claim those three murders. So I believe it was after 19, I can't remember the last one before then, but it was the one before 1985, Marine
okay.
Hedge, that he quit communicating, quit taunting the police. You know, and the whole public thinks, okay, he's incarcerated, he's dead. You know, I grew up, I was a teenager through this time. I thought, oh, okay, safe now, forgot about him.
Right.
2004, he reemerges, and he starts, well, I take that back, I have a theory about that, but he reemerges, starts recommunicating in 2004. In his recommunication, he used his BTK codes, and he sent pictures of his 1986 victim plus copies of her driver's license that authenticated that it wasn't a copycat. It was the real deal. you know, after all these years, you know, I think he quit communicating for, you know, over 10 years, 15 years.
But he hadn't committed any more crimes after the time in which your aunt and another coworker saved his life.
No.
Right. So in a way, we only know who, we only have been able to solve all these crimes really because of your aunt. If she hadn't saved his life and he hadn't been caught, they probably never would have figured it out posthumously, do you think?
Probably not. You know, it's like, why would anybody ever go and dig up his yard or go through his house and look
right.
at these things? You know, you're absolutely right.
Or it might have taken another 10 or 15 years when somebody was tearing down that house or something like that, when they find evidence and they're saying, holy smokes, who's this? And they finally
they
went back and
tore the house down, except for it was his house.
Right. So tell me about that little side comment you made about why you thought in 2004 he started to send notes again to the police.
Well, everybody's theory is that he reemerged and he started re-communicating, and that he had gone dormant, you know, so to speak, until 2004. I don't think he ever went dormant. You know, he may not have been communicating, but in 2001, I walked up on his truck out in the parking lot to tell him I had locked everything up in the office, and laying in the seat next to him was a picture of a blonde in a bra. And, you know, I was a little shocked and taken back. You know, I was like, oh, gross. You know, you know, it's like walking up on somebody with a Playboy or something. And
right.
he's got this picture next to him. So, but he made no attempt to hide it, cover it up, or anything. You know, I told a few other people about it, you know, and I said, hey, Dennis is a little bit on the weird side.
Right.
And, you know, then during his sentencing hearing in 2005, August of 2005, it comes to light that he has thousands of these pictures that he's cut out of magazines. He's either licked the underwear off of them or he's erased them off of them, but he has thousands of these pictures, and he calls them slicks. He gives them names, calls them his girlfriends, and they go on patrol with them.
Now,
he recommunicated in 2004, but yet I walked up on that truck in 2001. He was still trolling. He was still doing all the creepy, weird things that created the mind that he had, that, you know, of a subhuman.
Right. And I want to go back to that. So he didn't have, like, porno pictures per se with the underwear already off of the women, but women who he was clipping out of, say, what, like Sears ads for ladies' underwear, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, out of you know, Sunday sell ads and out of magazines.
That's so
weird. And then
weird.
He was licking the picture or licking the clothing off
so
of them.
So strange. That's so weird. That's one of the weirdest things I've ever heard.
You would really think he was weird and strange.
Yeah, well, so how did you, I mean, did you ever have your fear that you would become a victim or that you somehow avoided an attack from him?
Well, the first 5 years that I worked with Dennis, you know, if you knew me real well, you'd know that I'm a real opinionated, I'm strong-willed, and I don't back down or give up. In that first 5 years, I stood my ground with him. I complained every day. You know, I filed my grievances. You know, I did what I had to do. But I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of running me off.
Well, let's back up for a second. What grievances about what? Help me out with that.
About his treatment towards me. He was a bully.
What would he say? Typically, what would he do?
You know, it's not so much what he would say as his actions. And his actions were to put fear in me, to intimidate me, to belittle me, you know, like jabbing at a notebook and just keep pushing at it and speaking and asking me a question, but keep talking and not allowing me an opportunity to answer the question, just to stand there and just belittle me and put me beneath him. And it was this type of behavior. But how do you repeat that to a superior and say, this is what he did? And, you know, you're exaggerating that, Mary. You know, no, I wasn't, you know. And they tell me, carry a tape recorder. Well, you know what? I need to carry a camcorder.
Right.
You know?
Because it was more the way he looked at you and his gestures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would go to, you would file a grievance, and then how would he react to that?
Well, you know, my very first grievance that I filed with his superior, and only to have it kicked back to me and told that I had to file it with Dennis. And I said, but it's about Dennis. And he said, but it's in the personnel policy manual. This is how you have to do it. And I said, well, I take exception to that because how can he objectively, you know, review a complaint about himself?
Right.
They stood their ground, and that's the way it stayed. And it's the way it still is.
And so the grievances never went any further than your initial complaint. But who else did you talk to about it?
Oh, I talked to absolutely everybody. You know, there was close to 60 employees that worked for the city. You know, every day I would complain about Dennis, particularly that last year, complain about him to the point where people would start avoiding me. You know, they were just so sick and tired of hearing about it. But, you know, they didn't want to be around him either, but they weren't in the position I was. They didn't work under his supervision. I was the only person.
Could you
have
put it?
The only person that didn't get a 2.5% increase that last year.
Could you have put in for a transfer?
There was no other department to go to other than the police department. My father was the chief of police up until he retired in January of 2003, and it would have been a conflict or a nepotism problem.
A nepotism thing, yeah.
Right.
So, all right, so you couldn't do that. So you stay with Dennis Rader. Did you ever feel like there was one moment where you really saw that maybe, as you look back on it, that might have been your time, but the circumstances just weren't right for this lucky, if we're going to use that word, somewhat bumbling serial killer to get away with your crime?
Exactly. Yep, it sure was. And he was already, this was in May of 2004, he had already started re-communicating with the police department and the news media. Although I didn't know it, I knew that there was a change in his personality. But on this one particular day, he and I were going at it. I had my back to him, heard the door shut, and I turned around. He was standing in front of the door. He had locked it, and it was my only exit out. And I said, Dennis, open the door. He wouldn't open it, and I more forcefully and louder, Dennis, open the door. And he still wouldn't open it, so I got behind my desk really quick, got over to the telephone, and started intercomming for help, for somebody to come back there. He never said anything. It was just the look on his face and him starting to move towards me that just put the sheer fear in me.
I bet.
And at that point in time that I was on the phone trying to get somebody back there, he reached over, unlocked the door, opened it, went and sat at his desk like nothing happened. It was like a complete transformation. It was like you could almost watch somebody wipe a chalkboard. How do you make somebody understand?
That's the kind of thing that I want to see your book. I know it just came out, and I haven't had a chance even to look at it yet. But I mean, that has like Lifetime movie written all over it. I mean, that's just amazing. I mean, just all right. So wait, let me also circle back to one other thing, because you were talking about this earlier, and I just want to get a feeling for the timeline for it. He gets caught. You're still working together when he's arrested by police.
Yes.
Okay.
I was still working for the city of Park City, still working there. I had received my employee review from him on January the 25th, 2005, and I was the only employee for the city that didn't get a minimum 2.5% increase. My review by him was so bad that on February 2nd, I gave myself a birthday present, and I resigned, and I gave a two-week notice, and Dennis's boss talked me out of it, and he told me, he promised me he would make sure that he can get this to committee this time so I wouldn't have to go to Dennis, because I was trying to make him understand at that time without really coming out, hey, I'm afraid of him.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was picking up a vibe where, you know, your hair's just standing up on you all the time. Well, he talked me out of quitting, and that last week that Dennis and I worked, we only actually physically worked together that Monday and Tuesday. He was off on Wednesday. I took a floating day on Thursday. Friday, I woke up and said, there ain't no way I'm going into work today and working with him. I couldn't do it. Couldn't pull myself out of bed to do it. And that afternoon, I got a phone call to go into City Hall, and the mayor and Dennis's boss met me in the court chambers and told me that I was being sent home with pay till further notice, that they were complying with the federal investigation. I asked them, why was I being sent home? Was I being investigated? They would not tell me anything. They refused to answer my questions. I asked if I was the only employee being sent home. They said yes, and I, well, what am I supposed to think?
Well, I got to hear more about that. You got to hang on for just a few more minutes, can you? Okay. Mm-hmm. Give us a little bit more at the top of the hour. Mary Capps, my boss was the BTK killer. We'll hear the end of that story next on Coast to Coast.